So hello, everybody, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. Now, we're normally a podcast known for the most rigorous literary analysis and the most pretentious, self-inflated, obscurantist book talk. But we're going to do something a little bit different today. We're going to be even more inwardly focused, navel-gazing, and obscure, because we are actually going to talk about the recently published novel Gusano by our own Patrick Barney, who's not just, I think, not just one of the three current hosts of Book Spider, but was also really the impetus behind the creation of the predecessor podcast, God Setebos, and really, I think, the person who was the driving force behind the whole fact that, you know, the three of us or the three of us and occasional guests will take some time every other weekend to sit around and talk about books, which has been, you know, a really important thing, I think, in my life in terms of continuing to stay connected to things and to people that are important to me. And I've always been very, very grateful, Patrick, that you did that, right? That you had that idea and that you pushed it and that you, you know, stuck with it on, you know, the days when I forgot to read Jude the Obscure until like the day before and spent like rushing through it.
Well, I'm just happy that you guys are involved. Like, this has been one of the most important things in my life, 100%. And I'm glad that you guys are still want to meet every other weekend, every other Sunday or thereabouts, and chat about books, because like I really think that my life would be significantly worse if we didn't do this. So mutual feelings.
Mine as well, absolutely. Yeah, so you know, you're really kind of the linchpin of the podcast, I think, and you've published a novel, which we're all very happy about, and we've all read and enjoyed. And so, you know, I really couldn't see any option but to take some time to talk with you about it.
Right? Cool.
So Patrick's here. Our normal host Chris Malmberg is here, and then our old friend Eddie Kim, who we knew and lived with and studied with and occasionally slept with back in grad school,
and touched emotionally,
emotionally and physically. Mm-hmm. So
missed it so much.
Indeed, we all have. We all have. Mostly try to avoid thinking about how much I miss it.
Damn.
So, that got really real.
Yeah, I didn't mean for it to. We usually write the introductions out ahead of time. And so, you know, it's rare for me to extemporize when I'm doing this. And so that did get a bit realer than I meant, other than the part where I said that we slept together, which was not literally real. Yeah. Imaginatively real.
This is the best intro ever, definitely.
So if anybody's listening who hasn't read Gusano, the first thing I'd say is go read it before you listen to this podcast, right? Because it's pretty much impossible. It's going to be impossible for me, at least, to talk about it at any length without spoilers. And especially, you know, because the ending, I think, was very interesting to me, and also is something that seemed to me like it thematically unlocks a lot of the rest of the book. So, you know, I would heartily encourage you to read it. I think it's a fantastic novel. It sounds like you have to do a little bit of a Patrick. How do they find it if they want to get a hold of it?
Well, it looks, unfortunately, every time I've tried to just look it up on Amazon through my name or title, I've been unable to find it. So if you Google Anxiety Press, one of the links that will pop up is a link to their specific Amazon web shop. So click on Anxiety Press Amazon link, and my book will be there. They've published, like, it seems like they move pretty fast. So they published two or three or four books since my book. So you might have to search a little bit. But that's the best way to find it, is going directly through Anxiety Press's Amazon shop. Another option, if you don't care about Amazon, a friend of mine has found the book on bookshop.org. If you are familiar with that and you just want to type my name and the title in bookshop.org, that will get you there as well.
And I actually just Googled it, and it's coming up pretty quick, just Googling it. Gusineau Patrick Barney.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so like
maybe it just took a second for like websites to catch up or something.
Maybe
it's probably just all the people searching for it.
Yeah,
that's probably what it is. Yeah.
Well, and preferably actually Amazon is kind of far down, so you know, fuck Amazon, but Powell's Books is near the top. Mm. And Mayers and Quinn Booksellers is near the top. I don't have no idea what is.
I just did too.
Yeah, so there's a few options that pop up near the top when you Google it. So, you have to Google Patrick's name as well. So Gusineau Patrick Barney should pull it up.
And you can see a pretty cool image of the cover if you like. Yeah.
Yeah, I was able to find yours just with the Amazon search.
Oh, all right. I'm wrong.
Abroad.
I'm wrong.
For some reason in the UK, you can find it via an Amazon search, but I did have to scroll down a little. It probably helped that I knew exactly what I was looking for. So
right, yeah.
So if someone is looking for it and they don't know, you know, what the cover looks like or anything, they might just scroll past it or something real quick.
Right.
So Patrick, before we get into the real kind of nitty gritty of the book, because I've already kind of said, you know, if you haven't read it, duck out here, go get yourself a copy, read it, come back, listen to this episode then. But as kind of a last, you know, last concession to the folks who maybe are still sticking around despite not having read it, do you want to give like a brief, like, you know, back flap kind of spoiler-free intro just to give people a sense of what it is and what they can expect going into it?
Sure. I'll just read the synopsis or like not synopsis, but the kind of description I wrote for the website. On a simple trip to the grocery store, struggling businessman and father of four, Mick Jansen, discovers that he can turn people into giant worms. Haunted but intrigued by his newfound power, Mick tests its limits, wreaking havoc in the lives of everyone he knows, his wife, his kids, his mistress, and his employees. Soon enough, the police investigate the carnage that Mick leaves in his wake, and Mick realizes that it's only a matter of time before his life comes crumbling down. Will he be able to make everything all right again, like in a fairy tale, or does hell await? So it's a, you know, hopefully a smart horror novel that is heavy on ideas. I would is how I would describe it.
Excellent. So the first question that I had, and it's weird to start here maybe, but it just, you know, that it's something that was so much in my mind when I came away from the book. I actually want to start with the ending, if that's okay. I mean, I want to talk a little bit about my sense of what it meant and how it connects to the bigger novel, and then maybe have Eddie and Chris talk about their responses to it. And then, you know, Patrick, you don't have to tell us what it, you know, in an author intent sort of way means exactly, but I'd just be interested in hearing about your process for writing it and whatever response you have to our senses of what it adds up to, if that sounds okay to everybody.
For sure.
Sounds great.
Yep.
So the arc of the novel, of course, follows Mick Jansen, who discovers that he has developed the ability to turn people into worm mutants by touching them, right? And, you know, Mick is a, when we meet him, seems like a pretty irredeemable kind of a sleazebag, right? Mm-hmm. A pretty scummy dude. But, you know, over the course of the novel, we do see him. He gets both better and worse at the same time in ways, right? Like, we see him both. I think that we see greater amounts of his humanity, particularly in his care for his family. We see him make some legitimate attempts at self-critique and at coming to understand ways that he's been cruel to people. And at the same time, you know, when those attempts fail, or when he has when he makes what he believes to be an attempt at connection and is rebuffed, you know, he sometimes will lash out in even worse ways. So, you know, I think as the novel progresses, we see both we see both darker extremes of who he can be, and at the same time, we get a better sense of the things that are redemptive for him, right? So he becomes somehow both more and less sympathetic as the events of the novel unfold. And the penultimate scene finds him in his basement with a police officer, a police detective that he has taken captive, and his family, or his kids. His wife is no longer there because, of course, he's turned her into a worm mutant and then cut her up with a chainsaw. And he is surrounded by police who, you know that they're pretty sure that he's the person who's been responsible for all these worms. And they are, he's trying to figure out how to solve that, and has kind of an intuition that there's some way that he can change everything that's happened through some kind of positive inversion of the power that he's been using to create these worms. And he musters up all the goodness in himself, touches himself in the way that he would touch someone to turn them into a worm, and then in a kind of abrupt way, we go to him waking up in kind of a version of a story that has been told to him by one of the police officers earlier. So earlier in the novel, there's a kind of this surreal detour where he's talking to one of the investigating officers, and the officer tells him a story about being a settler on Mars and having most of a platoon destroyed in an attempt at in kind of a failed battle tactic. And at the time, you know, he writes that off as kind of a just kind of like a weird bullshit hallucination. But then he wakes up in a version of that story, discusses tactics with another settler / military officer, and they realize that they need to sacrifice themselves to protect their family from the, I believe they're meant to be understood as aliens that are menacing them. And so he makes that decision, and that's the end of the novel. And as far as, I mean, I guess I understood that to be kind of, oh gosh, how would I put it? A way of it has an intuitive truth to it, right? It has an emotional truth to it. The intuitive emotional truth is that his care for his family is ultimately what matters, and that is the thing that most redeems him. And I don't know what the literal relationship is, the literal causal relationship is between his experience in what's the reality of most of the novel and the kind of the vision of Mars. If there is a way that that is explained where there's a clear sense of, I mean, it would be easy to say, I guess, that like the whole novel is the dream of the Mars officer, right? And he wakes from that dream with an understanding of what he has to do. And that seems like an oversimplification to me, right? It's more like in some way he kind of transports himself between planes of reality so that he into a reality where he can carry out the understanding that he's gained. But it's not so simple as one thing being a dream or another and another being reality, at least the way that I took it. It has a more kind of surreal aspect to it. I don't know. Chris, Eddie, what do you guys think about that ending, and how are there keys that I've been missing about what it means or what it points to?
Well, I'll say, like, I definitely read it as an intuitive connection between the two, do we get a name for the character at the end, or do we just assume his name is also Mick Jansen? I don't remember. What's his rank? That might actually be easier to.
He's a captain. I'm pretty sure he's captain.
He's a captain.
The name is never mentioned.
Okay, so Mick and the captain, I think maybe is easier to shorthand to talk about them, even if they're the same person. And I thought of like Lost Highway, sort of like two stories that are overlapping in ways and seem to influence each other, but also could sort of stand on their own, and the kind of like snake eating its own tail or a Boros loop that might or might not connect them. And that felt, I kind of gravitate toward a more an intuitive reading of things like this. And I'm more interested in those than in sort of like the clockwork, more empirical connections that might explain like how like they're related to one another. And I felt there was something about how the Arcadians, the enemy, is sort of described but not seen as this sort of approaching, dominant, overbearing force that felt symbolic of something, that maybe on a second read through, and I didn't actually find an issue with the fact that, like, I didn't necessarily know what. It felt like a kind of potential symbolic weight of the Arcadians being this force that the captain and his platoon need to repel somehow. And that was enough for me. And there was something to that sense of sacrifice that sort of bridged the two, that made it feel earned and good.
And moving, I think, partly because it, you have a change in the imagery, you have a change in the setting, but the emotion carries over, right? And the way, the kind of, the unifying emotional sense between the two and the way that spans them, I'm not saying this very articulately, but that I found that that enhanced it, right? Like it, I think it was more, if you think about reaching the ending of Mick's story, he has this realization, he touches himself in the attempt to, expunge all this badness, and something unexpected has to happen there, right? Mm-hmm. There's a version of the novel where he fails and his life is over and that's that. And there's a version of the novel where he succeeds, and that, I think, to some extent undermines the seriousness of what's come before, right? And kind of undermines the darkness that really is kind of also there at the core of him. And so to kind of take this third way, where we have a way of symbolizing all these things and understanding the emotional truth of what he's done without following either of the obvious kind of plot paths to express that, I think is very ingenious, and I liked it a lot. Chris, you made the Lost Highway comparison. I think if it reminded me of anything, it was Zeroville by Steve Erickson.
Oh, yeah.
That's not, in like a plagiaristic way, just that was the closest to the way the device was used that I could think of in another book.
I just wanted to say that I absolutely thought of Zeroville Like the ending to Zeroville was like I was wondering how to end it, and my original ending I thought wasn't I didn't think it was quite right, and so I thought, well, how do I end this? And I remembered Zeroville, and I was like, okay, something like that is how this needs to go. So, yeah.
And I do think, I mean, maybe this is going to sound like blowing smoke up your ass. As much as I loved Zeroville, it felt like a more satisfying and intentional version of that technique. I think Zeroville is, it's so left field, and that's not, that novel is so thematically obscure that it probably by design, it does end up being kind of unsatisfying, right? I mean, it. I love Zeroville, and I find that ending fascinating. But I think that you're like, there's an obscurity to how it's used there that yours, I think, is a little. Yours is not afraid to be a little more resonant in a fuller sort of way, right? And so I think that was the big difference between how I took this and how I took the ending of Zeroville, despite the kind of, you know, influence of the technique.
I'll let Steve Erickson know that. We're friends on Facebook. I'll message him. I'll be like,
I feel like for me, the ending, like, opens the book up a lot. In a weird way, I feel like that story, like, I felt almost more implicated as a reader. In the sense that I felt like it wasn't like neatly wrapped, right? It was a satisfying ending, but it was a way that I felt like it was kind of open to interpretation. And so, in a way that that character, you know, Mick is like exploring, you know, doing a lot of self-exploration. And I feel like that ending sort of in a weird way opened me up to self-exploration through that, the story and the character as well.
Sweet.
It's actually a really cool point because I was thinking about, like, you know, what does the ending actually do? I think that there's like a thematic effect to the ending that, you know, like there is this set, the theme of sacrifice and the theme of other and of strangeness. but I think, you know, just kind of at a I don't know, I sort of almost, I don't know, subtext isn't the word for this, but you go through that ending and it does work that couldn't be accomplished within Mick's story as it was told, of not necessarily redeeming him, but creating space to empathize with him, maybe, that it doesn't really matter that he makes this very gracious choice at the end of his story. The fact that the captain exists creates space for connecting with Mick, as abhorrent as he is, I think, in ways that it's just not possible to get there with Mick himself. Like, you have to kind of like elevate the story to this other plane.
Right. Cause if you're looking at like Mick and the captain as parallels, then for me, at least, like for Mick as a human being, as a fellow human being, like you, like, I feel like there's a familiarity with that character that you have, like people that you've met or people that you know, that can sometimes make it harder to empathize. But I like, one of the things I love about the book is that it did make me empathize with this person that, you know, I found despicable in a lot of ways. And but I feel like it's in a weird way that, like, when you take it into, like, you know, what seems like an alien race of some kind or something happening somewhere else, that it allowed me to be actually more kind of like view it from a more objective point of view. I wasn't like encumbered by my humanness, maybe.
I think there's a flip side to that too, though, where, you know, we don't really know the background of the conflict on Mars. Mm-hmm. We don't know really who the new Arcadians are. And so just as knowing Mick in depth makes it more complicated to ever appreciate whatever redemption he might find, there's almost certainly a perspective on, I would imagine at least, like, and you don't really have time to reflect on any of this, but there must be a version of this story, the ending, the story in the ending, where these are the villains, right?
Right.
I mean, the choice of New Arcadian is very interesting because the... I was just in Louisiana a month or so ago, and I had never known the history of the Arcadians who became the Cajuns, right? But, like, that is a persecuted people. And, you know, to name your antagonists in the ending after, like, a people who've been persecuted in history, I don't know how deliberate any of that was, but it suggests a way in which there's actually maybe an ambiguity to that story and to the goodness or badness of that that we're not able to understand because we're in that frame for such a short period of time. And at the same time, it maybe kind of suggests that there are certain human values that transcend... certain human values that transcend circumstance, right? That are mm-hmm. that are noble regardless of broader circumstances that might render someone on a bigger scale a villain or a hero. Or maybe that those are to some extent contingent and meaningless terms.
Yeah, I think especially because I feel, you know, like you think about it's a matter of perspective. And, like, you know, every kind of in any conflict, everyone is sort of like the Rebel Alliance, if you will. You know, everyone's like think that they're fight. I mean, even if you look at even like now the way that Americans view, like the way we like kind of view ourselves is we often view ourselves as like, you know, like some kind of rebellion like force, but we're actually really not, you know, we're so very clearly on the other end, you know, we're the empire type of stuff. And like, you know, you hear people make that parallel all the time. And it's like very, like, it's almost to the point where it's cliche to acknowledge that for like me to even say that. It seems kind of ridiculous, but I forget where I was going with that. I think there's, it's an interesting thing to like that, and that's what kind of opens up for me and makes it a lot more complicated in an interesting way.
You mentioned something, Eddie. Well, I guess I was going to transition a little bit, but Patrick, was there anything else you wanted to say about the ending? You've already talked a little bit about some of the influence and how you came to it. Is there any big thing that we missed that you want to grab us by the lapels and yell in our face about?
No.
Or, okay.
No, I mean, yeah, I want it to be an open ending, something that can be widely interpreted. And as long as it's successful thematically, then that's what I'm trying to shoot for. So.
I did have one question, actually, now that I think about it. So you mentioned that you had originally written a different ending and then changed it to this.
Mm-hmm.
The sequence earlier in the novel where one of the officers talks about a version of this story, did that exist before this ending, or did you go back and put that in to seed this ending?
That existed before this ending. Like when
That's interesting.
When the detective, you know, tells him this weird, whacked out story about a Martian war, I just kind of wanted to go to the absurdist register and be crazy. But then, you know, when I had the idea for the new ending, I say new, but really all it was I originally intended to end it at Mick, you know, attempting to transform himself into a worm, and then the novel just ends. And then I thought that I kind of wanted to have something of a resolution chapter. I typically like it when there's at least some form of a resolution chapter. That would be my only gripe about someone like, say, John Steinbeck. He often ends his novels without a resolution chapter. Like, he just, the climax happens and it's over. So I wanted a resolution chapter, and I just had, like, I don't know why, just had the idea that it should connect to the Hammersmith story. Maybe just to make us wonder, like, was Hammersmith bullshitting? Or was he telling the truth? And, like, you know, I thought that would connect nicely with the idea that Mick has, that you know, we're in a fairy tale. You know, like, that would actually make it, like, if it just ends with him killing himself, turning himself into a worm, and no resolution, then we don't actually, I don't think we actually entertain the idea that maybe it's a fairy tale. I think we probably think it's just right. Not, you know.
I think also maybe not. I was going to say, like, if it ends with him turning himself into a worm, then that poses the question of, like, do you have a chapter from the worm's perspective? Like, it kind of leads it opens up the whole question of, will the novel tell us about the subjectivity of the worms and how they feel and experience, which is totally, you know, currently not addressed, right. Probably rightly so. Mm-hmm. Eddie, were you going to say something? I feel like I cut you off.
I think that was Chris.
Oh, okay. Well, I always cut him off.
I think I just was struck by the, because I had the similar question about the Hammersmith story. It felt like it had to be something that was inserted after you had decided or found that particular ending. So I'm really tickled that that's not the case. Mm. You know, it seems, you know, this is maybe, like, I don't want to stick with the ending too much, but as a subject, but it just is such an interesting feature of the novel. Like, it's a weird connection to make, but I've read that, like, the Napoleonic Wars are actually really important to understanding Jane Austen novels. Like, the characters, even though the wars don't feature directly, you know, in the plots at all, the characters' motivations and, like, the backdrop, the subtext of basically everything that's going on is muted somewhat by these distant wars. In the way that fragment, you know, if it had just jumped to the ending, then I think that might be too jarring, one. But I think the other aspect of the fragment, you know, with Hammersmith's story is that it, you know, there's the fragment, the ending, there's this kind of question, like, the captain can't quite remember his life before, it seems. And it seems like there's, you know, some room for these two worlds to kind of coexist in a way that is maybe impossible to reconcile. And it makes me want to, like, go through the novel again and think about, like, even if there isn't a war going on, like, consciously in the minds of these characters on Mars, some distant battle, like, is there something to this feeling of, you know, stakes of a distant battle that, you know, informs how you read, like, these characters on Earth who are living otherwise mundane lives.
So this came up a little bit in conversation, but I really just wanted to touch back on it because I think it's such a key feature of the novel, right? And that is the the delicate balance between the fundamental loathsomeness of Mick as a character for most of the novel and the kind of underlying humanity that he shows and the ways that he intermittently keeps trying to make redemptive gestures, or that he, you know, that he goes to therapy or tries to be nicer to the employee that he's sleeping with or things like that, right? And I mean, I think we've already talked on an earlier episode of the podcast about the delicacy of that balance, right? And earlier in the podcast, we talked about, or in an earlier episode, rather, of the podcast, when we briefly talked about this book, we mentioned then the daringness of the choice to lead off with the worst version of the character, right? To put us in the most repulsive viewpoint of the most repulsive version of the character, and to kind of introduce the notes of humanity over time, and, you know, made the point that that's, I think, very compelling, but also something a lot of people might be scared to do because it can be off-putting, right? Like, it would probably be more common in a lot of films or books, it would be more common to lead off with a more approachable version of the character and gradually reveal darkness, right? And I think I made the comparison to The Player, the Altman film, and many other examples that one could bring up there. And I remember when you were trying to publish this book, you had a publisher suggest that you tone down the initial unpleasantness of Mick, which, having read it now, I understand why you were stubborn about that, right? Because that would kind of undermine the whole aesthetic, like the real kind of, from a craft standpoint, the real magic here is going to such lengths to make someone unappealing and then managing to undermine that unappealingness with a kind of deeper sense of why he is that way and what kind of forces have led him to, both in and out of his control, have kind of turned him into this person. And anyway, so I mean, I think, like, first of all, that really just kind of has to be acknowledged as one of the key drivers of what makes this compelling, and I assume one of the things that you found most interesting and challenging about writing it. But I guess I was just going to ask, what kind of adjustments did you have to make to get that balance right? Is there a version of this where he's much worse? Is there a version of this where he's much better somewhere in your drafts folder? Or were you able to come to that pretty instinctively?
I'd say pretty instinctively. It didn't really seem too much like a struggle to do that. Like, it wasn't like this was this novel, unlike the novel that I'm currently writing, came together pretty easily. I've told you guys before that the novel I'm currently writing, I've been working on for years and years and years and years. And Hans, you've seen a version of it, and I've rewritten huge swaths of it. So, but this novel came together in about 6 months. Only really minor revisions were needed. And my process is probably to make revisions as I go along. You know, I'll write a chapter or whatnot, and then, you know, once I get more ideas about where the story is going, I will go back and fix a passage here, a passage there. Hopefully that's not disappointing to you, Hans, that, like, it, like, you're like, it's a delicate balance, and I'm like, I just did it. You know, hopefully that's okay.
Right.
Did you find yourself, like, I'm kind of curious if you found yourself, like, accessing parts that you maybe weren't always, like, you weren't always aware were there, or do you feel like it was just, like, these are things that you, like, kind of aspects of human nature that you've, like, kind of thought about a lot, and so it just came out naturally, or did you find yourself kind of surprised by that process?
Uh, No, I mean, I've always so this kind of like the reason for constructing the character this way kind of has its origin in two things. So a long time ago, I wrote a novella where one of the characters, the main antagonist, was too flat. So I gave Hans an early version of the novella, and he said, "Well, I like the main character, but the antagonist isn't round enough. He's just an evil person, and you need to make him more of a person." So like that novella didn't end up working, but that piece of advice has always stuck with me since then, that like even our bad characters should be rounded, or should be rounded, they should be surprising, they should be satisfying to read about. So I always knew I wanted to create an evil but satisfying character. So hopefully I've done that. So that's one kind of piece of one driving force behind the creation of this character. And another is comes can kind of goes back to what Hans was saying about how in films or more popular novels, you would start with a character who is more approachable, more likable, even if he's a dick. Like one publisher suggested that I give him kind of a confident dick type persona, which he's not. He's a dick, but he's mixed, not confident. He's pathetic. Right.
That's like the whole driving force for who he is and how he
Right,
behaves.
exactly.
Yeah.
And I like this the kind of the point that I'm not necessarily making a huge point about it, but it's an aesthetic decision because I tend to dislike that character arc. The movie The Player is an exception. I think that I really enjoy that movie, but I kind of am always disappointed by the character arc where we start out with a character that we might like, and then we get deeper and deeper into his psyche, and we start disliking this character. I don't really like that arc. It's not something that I've ever found very satisfying in art films or anything like that. And so I really wanted to undermine or not necessarily undermine, but create an inversion of that arc. An arc where we start with a character that is thoroughly despicable, and then kind of move into more empathetic territory. And it just feels more satisfying to me that way. I'm not sure why. Like, not I won't say I'm not sure. I will just say that the effect of realizing you hate a character brings up more nasty emotions in me. And so I kind of just would prefer for empathy to grow over the course of the novel. But, that's just a personal preference. But that's kind of where it comes from.
And there's a challenge that it creates, which is how do you get people far enough in to start to develop that more complex relationship to the character, right? How do you get people through the first 15 or 20 pages and compel them to stick long enough with a dislikable person
Right.
or an off-putting viewpoint to understand the deeper sympathy that might eventually be there, right? And so did you give any thought to that when you were writing it? Like, how do I make this readable in spite of the grossness of my viewpoint character?
I hoped that the basic scenario that I came up with would give you a kind of, hopefully a genre style investment in just kind of being a voyeur and seeing what happens. So like, even if you hate the character, you're willing to like go along for horror's sake. It was kind of what I hoped. And then of course I love genre work. I really love genre novels. Sci-fi and horror are like good horror anyway. But my constant experience as a reader is when I read a genre novel, I'm like, this is fun, but it'd be better if the writing were better. You know, like the characters were more interesting and the writer had more of a worldview and an aesthetic value. And so that's what I feel when I read a lot of genre novels. And when I read more literary novels, not always, like maybe 50-50, maybe 50% of the time I'm like, this writing's really good, but I would really like an actual story. I mean, I realize I'm just kind of explaining my personal preferences and my own process, but
and also dismissing nearly all novels.
Right. Yeah. Like there is a,
you're essentially taking the position that the novel was broken on both the literary and the genre level, and that you have essentially saved the novel by finding the redeeming features of both forms and unifying them in an unprecedented way.
Yeah, I mean, how I do say all the time that I'm a genius. I hope you guys.
You do, absolutely. You're not. He's not joking.
I mean, I will say that the first half of the book, there were times when I was like, I don't know if I'm enjoying this, but I felt compelled to continue.
Right.
And then, like, I think I told you this before, where I was like, when I got to the second half, I couldn't put it down.
Right.
And then the first half, I was like, I don't know if I'm enjoying this. And so,
fair enough.
I was like, I don't know what's, yeah. And I was like, you know, and you know, there's just so much, it's so uncomfortable to read at times.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, just marking more specific, like, I think probably a similar experience, but like, after he turns his wife Caroline into a worm and then begins to like talk to her, that, you know, I think that there's it feels like, it felt like just an interesting, good choice, you know, craft wise to kind of like to do that and to have,
that's, I think, one of the things chapters that, to write.
Oh yeah, good. How do you make someone unlikable, or very, very toxic? It's not that you like him; it's that you're willing to give him time. And I think that, you know, Mick has just shown wavering on complex points of uncertainty a lot in a way that humanizes him.
Yeah,
and you know, it helps to, obviously, if he was you know, more competent and confident, it might be impossible to like this person doing these things. But he seems positioned to struggle in ways that feel, you know, human, and to doubt and to, you know, kind of waver on such points as, you know, getting the cat to torture it, then, you know, like kind of deciding that, you know, he really likes the cat, and then deciding to kill the cat but being unable to, and like, you know, just that, but also like, you know, turning his wife into a worm, then very much divulging to the worm in ways that he never could, you know, to his wife, all of these like all of these things that, you know, like are going on in his life and things that happened to him, and then fucking the worm, you know, and like all of the fucking the worm, by the way, Patrick, if that
it's separate.
That's when I knew this was a Patrick. I was like, oh, Patrick's I'm good. Patrick's carrying me to the end here. But no, I think that like
my
those
favorite part of the novel, definitely.
Well, that too, it you know, like it's not it's basically like those moments are really kind of carried me out of a place of feeling, you know, just sort of like, oh, Mick, I can't stand Mick, into a place where I really wanted to see what happened. And I think that, you know, that's, you know, we do this podcast to talk about craft. I think that's a craft thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't sure what reaction people would have. I was just hanging out with my board game friends yesterday, and then, you know, they had both read it, because and they wanted to talk a little bit about it, and one of them Jed pointed out that he had to readjust when he found himself feeling things for the narrator, because he had assumed that I had just written a novel to lambast a corporate asshole, right? So hopefully, basically, I just hope that, you know, the decisions I made were the correct ones in most cases, to keep people interested, to keep people on board, even though, you know, Mick is horrible and sleazy. You know, hopefully it was enough. It wasn't enough for my mother. Like, she read the whole thing because I wrote it, but she definitely was upset by the novel. She liked the
worm fucking part, though.
I don't know. She didn't say anything about it.
She wanted more of that.
But
like, that's more courageous than I was. I mean, my mom has asked on several occasions for a copy of my novel, and I have not provided her with one. So.
Are you serious? You should give her one. What's her address? I'll mail her. I'll mail her one. You know, I have copies around the house still. Yeah, she was real upset that, like, she was like, you told me this was a horror novel. I thought you were going to give up all this highbrow stuff. And I said, well, I mean, it's a horror novel. It's definitely horrifying, but it's, you know, horror can be highbrow. And she was also really upset that, like, I didn't explain anything. Like, she was not happy with the ending. She wants me to write a sequel from Detective Hammersmith's perspective, where he investigates further into the issue and everything is revealed. Like, she wants to know everything. I didn't succeed for everyone, I think. Like, and this is my own mother. She has to support me.
Can I tell you, the Gusineau affected my dreams a bit, because...
Oh, awesome. Hope you fucked a worm.
Because No, I didn't fuck a worm. We've been watching a lot of Bluey. Because,
oh, sure, yeah. my kids watch Bluey all the time.
Yeah, so basically I had a dream, and I don't remember, like, all of it super well, like... I really don't remember much of it at all, except for the fact that, like, this, it was like Gusineau, but it was Bandit. The was Mick, and he was turning fucking, like, anthropomorphic cartoon dogs into, like, green slime spewing worms. So
that's awesome.
I think, yeah, no, I was pretty delighted. I usually, like, I wake up from my weird, I think this is part of, like, growing up too. I used to be scared of dark dreams. Now I wake up from dark, weird dreams, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that was fucking awesome. So, no, thank you for that, Patrick.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I couldn't help noticing that you wrote yourself into
the story. That's right, yes.
You practiced a little bit of self
immolation, too. Yeah. You're wearing an immolation shirt, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, a two-part question, I guess. Like, the first part would be, was there any rationale for that beyond just fucking around? And then the larger question would be, if anyone here is based at all on anyone that you know personally, how do you think about the process of drawing on real people for fictional characters? And what is it? What are the kind of advantages and pitfalls and process for that, if that's a thing that you have done here, which I'm not saying you have.
Okay. So the reason that a character who bears some similarity to me is in there is mostly like just I'm trying to think of the right analogy, but like just a kill switch or something like that to let you know fairly quickly that I'm not advocating disgusting behavior. Like there, it's kind of, I'm sure we've all heard this, but like, you know, at some point it becomes hard to distinguish satire from reality. You know, like it is very possible to write something that you think is absolutely satire that another whack job person will look at and be like, this is awesome. You know, like, I fully support what's happening here, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking about that. Like, I was watching a video about The Wall earlier today, the Pink Floyd movie,
yeah.
And that made the point that, like, I'm not sure how familiar you guys all are with The Wall, but there's, toward the end of it, there's a kind of like a parody of a fascist movement that has marching hammers as a symbol, which, of course, I mean, you know, was designed as a critique of British neo-fascism and a way of making it all look ridiculous. And that, you know, a few years later, there were actual fascist groups who kind of took the hammer image in tribute to that.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a bit like, you're saying it's a bit like if you had a character named Roger Waters show up and say, fascism is bad.
Right, exactly. Exactly. you know,
except more subtle. I mean, I'm kind of making it sound cartoonish, but like, it's sort of an equivalent.
Right.
A more subtly done equivalent.
Right. I'm just trying to, like, you know, make sure that readers know that there is a different perspective, that, you know, that was something that Chinua Achebe critiqued about Joseph Conrad's work. Like, you know, why, if we're meant to think that all this stuff in Heart of Darkness is horrible, then why didn't he, you know, do a better job of offering an alternative perspective? And, you know, Achebe's answer is, well, he didn't do that because he's a bloody racist, you know, his words. So I just wanted to make sure that I was covering that base. That's why
a kinder comparison maybe being the limbless person in Starship Troopers.
Exactly.
The recruiting officer who says, oh, the military made me the man I am today, pan down, and he's got no limits.
Right, exactly.
It's the one moment that the mask is allowed to slip
right.
enough to resolve the ambiguity that might otherwise be there about the point.
Right, exactly. So to your other question, how do I feel about basing fictional characters on real life characters, which I did do, like Mick is based on a former boss of mine who is pretty disgusting in all the ways that I make him out to be. You know, for example, the scene where, you know, Mick asks Patrick, you know, what's that shirt you got on? And he's like, immolation, it's death metal, you should check it out. And he says, I'd rather be fucked in the ass by four black men. You know, that was a real thing that my boss said. Another real thing that my boss said was, you know, a company that he was working with really did ask him to find non-white, non-male presenters for a conference in Barcelona. And he really did ask if a black trans woman counted as three. My former boss is definitely the inspiration for this character.
This maybe also gives us some sense of how you were able to write it so quickly.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But yeah. Can we talk just really about Mick company and the work that he's doing, because
Loyalty United.
Yeah. First of all, fucking great name. As soon as I read Loyalty United, that's another Patrick. Like, oh, Patrick's got me in his. I'm in good hands here.
I'm glad you felt that way.
Well, so, you know, I like right now, like I work in higher education and I do some work with, you know, vendors and companies that mm-hmm. like are kind of in betweeners or whatever, you know, like that. And it feels there's these companies out there that feel like they exist to parasitize what other people are doing, and it just I just wanted to say that, like, I still don't understand what Loyalty United does, which is the perfect note to strike.
I think
with a company like that, and Mick's sort of reflexive defensiveness about the value of what he's bringing to the world is also spot on for, these largely like they're functionally they're capitalist polyps that grow on the mm-hmm. surface of other organizations.
Exactly.
And they're just really I liked that aspect of it, and I couldn't tell at the very beginning just because of like how you're introduced to Mick, but like I couldn't tell if he was really all that hot shit or not. And then he goes into his office and it's all one room. And it's, you know, so I valued all of that very much.
So to answer the question, Hans, I think it's probably fine to, I think it's fine if you want to base a character on a real person. Obviously, I am not going to write a novel featuring a character that is like based on my wife. Like, I'm not going to do that. That would be stupid and, you know, there wouldn't be any reason to do that.
Yeah, like, if Caroline was based on your wife, you'd be in fucking trouble.
Yeah.
Sir.
Like there's no, like you can't do that to someone you respect and care about. But given that I don't respect or care about the asshole that I used to work for, here's the character. You know,
is there,
go ahead.
Leaving aside the ethics of it, was there ever a moment where you thought, you know, like you write someone who's a real person and at some point it's like you have to kind of do an act of creation to kind of cut the umbilicus in a way, right? Mm-hmm. To like, to say like, this is my moment of invention where I, of whole cloth, make something that is an aspect of this person that now makes them an independent fictional character,
right,
instead of an imitation of X or Y real world person, right? Did you have a moment like that with Mick?
Yeah, I don't know where specifically it happened, but I knew that though I really wanted to use the person that Mick is based on as a way to develop like a real asshole kind of corporate culture type character to critique corporate culture and how it like makes objects out of human beings. I also knew that I didn't just want to write a revenge novel. I didn't want to just like, you know, like my friend last night thought I was just going to lambast this character. And I knew from very early on that I did not want to do that. I wanted to write like an actual novel with a character that experiences some type of you know, conflict within himself, and that the character should show some redeeming qualities. Whether or not he is ultimately redeemable is another question, but some real human qualities. So, like I said, I'm not sure exactly when that happened, but you know, I differentiated between the actual person and the character. The character becomes his own fictional entity at the exact moment that you feel like there's something human about him. Like, believe it or not, I feel like this character is more human than my boss. Granted, you know, I only interacted with my boss in, you know, a work scenario, so I wouldn't have gotten access to those moments when he was a genuine human being. Hope that makes sense.
Hope that's enough to save you from getting sued.
Well, he'd probably have to know about it in the first place, which I assume he never
Yeah,
will.
He'd have to be able to read books and
He is a very litigious person, though. Like, 2 or 3 weeks into working there, a colleague told me to look up, as a matter of public record, all the court cases pending against him and that he has started. So,
All right. Well, I mean, that's pretty much everything that I was wondering about. Chris, Eddie, are there questions you guys had that I've kind of been running the show here. If there are any questions that you had or aspects you wanted to cover that have been that I've trampled on, I really want to make sure that you have space to bring those out and address that.
no, my questions were about Mick and about the fragment about the Arcadians earlier in the novel Hammersmith story. So we've gotten
Sure.
to those.
Yeah, same. I do have like a question that just kind of popped into my head as we were talking a second ago. Did you find that like writing, finding the humanity in a character like this, like, was it like a hopeful? Did it make you feel more full of hope, or did you make it make you feel more maybe, in some way connected to people that you may otherwise not care for?
The one thing that I have always found to be a conundrum is how people who are on the opposite political spectrum from me can share many of the same beliefs. So, for example, you guys remember the guy with the big horn helmet from the January 6th riot or insurrection.
How could you
You,
forget
the
him?
QAnon shaman.
So I was just like reading about the incident. I found out that this guy has been an activist against climate change for a long time. Like he has spoken out about governments not doing anything about climate change for a few years now. And which, you know, is mind-boggling. Like this guy believes in crazy whack job shit and feels like Trump should be a dictator, but at the same time, you know, has a perfectly clear head when it comes to climate change. And so that makes me feel strange, But also, like you said, Eddie, it does actually make me feel hopeful. Like if it seems to me that we, despite political differences, if we can talk about things that we actually believe, if we can openly say, instead of using, obviously I think capitalism is horrible, but when I say that, there's so much misunderstanding that stems from the fact that people define capitalism in different ways. To a person like the QAnon shaman, our government is probably not capitalistic. To someone like that, it's, they identify capitalism with the free market. Now, there are all kinds of things that I could say to that, to critique that idea and why I think that idea is wrong, but that stumbling block of defining capitalism in a different way than how I would define it, if we can at least know that there is this different definition, maybe we can still talk about things we do agree on, like how governments need to do something about climate change. Or I saw an interview with that weird face guy from Turning Point USA. I forget his name, but like somebody asked him, well, what do we do about the housing crisis? And he says, well, obviously we should deny corporations above who have more assets above a certain limit, I forget what he said, from participating in the housing market. Like if you have too much money, if you have a certain amount of money, you really don't need to be in this market whatsoever. Maybe that's not like the be all end all solution, but it's a reasonable suggestion. Corporate entities with so much money probably shouldn't be dealing, messing with housing. Like they shouldn't be buying up all these houses and getting a monopoly. A character like this does come from a place of hope.
Well, that seems like a pretty good place to end, I think, if that works for you folks. What are we reading next week?
I guess it's my turn. Is it my turn to pick since we did Don DeLillo and then Jeff Vandermeer?
Vandermeer.
Okay, so I'm going to reserve my like multi-episode pick for some other time. I'm not exactly sure what large work I would like to read. So we're just going to do a one episode this time on an author that we have talked about before, but we've never actually discussed, like devoted an episode to a book of his. And that is Stanisław Lem. And we're going to read his Master's Voice, which is, I didn't want to do Solaris because we've talked about that one in passing. And his Master's Voice is like a solid, funny novel with a lot of the same themes. But there are definitely some weird things about it. Like there's this weird prologue that I would like your guys's input on. But yeah, it should be a solid phone pick, I would think. Sorry, listeners, it looks like we forgot to say goodbye and thank you. So here I am coming back to say thanks for listening. Peace out until next time.